and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the release of the long-anticipated report by the Department of Justice Inspector General, who investigated former FBI Director Comey's handling of the Hillary Clinton email saga, which Trump has relentlessly tried to build up as a criminal outrage worse than Watergate in order to distract from the ongoing Mueller investigation into him and his family. Lisa Kern Griffin, a professor of law at Duke University who clerked for Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor and spent 5 years as a federal prosecutor in the Chicago United States Attorney's Office, joins us. We will discuss how the report's main finding is that Comey was insubordinate in his handling of the Clinton investigation, but it finds there was no bias in the FBI's decision to clear Clinton. However, buried in the 568 pages of this report are seven words that Trump and his Fox and Friends media allies are blowing up into a smoking gun to prove the deep state is out to get Trump. And that is an exchange of texts between a former Army officer and FBI agent, Peter Strzok, and his girlfriend, FBI lawyer Lisa Page, who asked rhetorically, "Trump's not ever going to become president, right? Right?" To which Strzok fatefully replied, "No, no, he won't. We'll stop it." Then we'll speak with Emma Brown, an investigative reporter at The Washington Post, where her latest article is Inside Casa Padre, the converted Walmart where the U.S. is holding nearly 1,500 immigrant children. We'll discuss the first access the press has had to a detention facility housing some of the 11,200 children now in federal custody. And while the excuse is given that the privacy of children is being protected, the U.S. public knows very little about the fate of children as young as breastfeeding babies who have been ripped from their mother's arms at the southern border, and the conditions in which they are being detained under what the Trump administration calls a zero-tolerance policy. Then finally, we'll get an update on the worsening situation in Yemen, which is already a humanitarian catastrophe, as a Saudi-led force moves on the port city of Hodeidah to close off the only access to aid for a country under a merciless blockade, which has resulted in a third of the country's population facing starvation. An expert on Yemen, Dr. Sheila Carapico, a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond and the author of Arabia Incognita, Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf, joins us to discuss the extent to which the U.S. has blood on its hands as a result of supporting and arming the Saudi war now threatening to destroy a city of 600,000. And joining us now is Lisa Kern Griffin, a professor of law at Duke University, who focuses on evidence theory, constitutional criminal procedure, and federal criminal justice policy. Previously, she clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor of the Supreme Court of the United States and also spent 5 years as a federal prosecutor in the Chicago United States Attorney's Office. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Kern Griffin.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And Lisa, what do you make of the long-anticipated Inspector General's report from the FBI looking into the way FBI Director Comey handled the Hillary Clinton email saga? And of course, just in terms of context, that President Trump has been relentlessly trying to build up this as a criminal outrage worse than Watergate. So did the smoking gun get delivered for Donald Trump?
I think that he will say that it did, but I don't think that it necessarily did. It's kind of mixed. There is something in the report for everyone. On the one hand, it does indeed criticize Director Comey for the timing and nature of his announcements with respect to the investigation, but it also affirms that there was no bias found in the investigation, and it confirms that the decision not to prosecute Hillary Clinton was likely the correct one given the standards that were applied. And you might think that that would shut down the sort of lock her up discourse and put an end to the story of that investigation. But unfortunately, the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails has been conflated with the Russia investigation, even though they are two decidedly separate things. And the fact that there are additional texts released in this report from FBI agents who were working on this investigation and who did briefly have some crossover assignments with the special counsel's investigation that are critical of the president and indeed suggest that the agents wanted him not to be elected in the first place will be trumpeted by the administration, and I'm sure that it will feed the deep state narrative we've been hearing.
But does the report in any way provide the context, which has always seemed extraordinary? Everybody, I think, and particularly the candidate herself, Hillary Clinton, believes that when FBI Director Comey went public a few days before the elections talking about some new emails that surfaced on the computer belonging to Hillary Clinton's aide, Humer, whose husband was already in disgrace, and it turned out that there was nothing there, but he felt the need to go public for whatever reasons, most of which people find pretty hard to believe. But the general consensus is it certainly hurt Hillary Clinton. Whether it denied her the presidency is a matter of debate. But I've always been astounded that President Trump has been able to make hay out of criticizing somebody who might well have helped make him president.
The president versus Director Comey narrative that is so much at the forefront now is one of the strangest turns of events in this entire saga, because there are a number of analysts who think that Director Comey is the best thing that happened to the president in the course of the campaign. And there isn't any evidence that Director Comey hurt the president in any way. And the decision not to prosecute Hillary Clinton now seems to be affirmed in a variety of ways. And somehow the president has managed, by conflating the conduct of the director in the course of the announcements made in the Clinton investigation with the connection between Director Comey and the launch of the Russia investigation, he's changed the story completely so that anything that casts aspersions on the FBI at the time of the Clinton email investigation seems to work in his favor with respect to the Russia investigation. I agree with you. It's a very strange turn of events.
But it would seem to me that within the 568 pages of this report, and arguably that's a lot about nothing, because I'm not sure at the end of the day, one, that this report was justified or necessary, and two, that the efforts sort of tantamount to the and the input and the, I guess the expense are tantamount to whatever takeaway there is. There just doesn't seem to be a lot there. But what clearly President Trump and his allies in the media are focusing on, and I've been getting emails all day from right-wing media outlets and think tanks heralding what is essentially only seven words in this 568-page report. And those words are in response to a text from the former U.S. Army officer and FBI agent Peter Strzok's girlfriend, FBI lawyer Lisa Page. She asked him rhetorically by text, "Trump's not ever going to become president, right? Right?" To which Strzok fatefully replied, "No, no, he won't. We'll stop it." And those are the seven deadly words, are they not?
I believe that that is the thing we are going to be hearing about the most from the report. I have not read the entire report, but as I understand the excerpts that I've read and the analysis that I have seen, it doesn't make a lot of news per se. It's a sort of assessment of things that are already in the public domain and that were, and for the most part, already widely known about the conduct of a variety of people involved in the Clinton email investigation. But those seven words, that exchange, cryptic though it may be, I don't know what is meant by that. I don't know whether "we'll stop it" is a reference to voting or a reference to some other action that someone might take. It may just be a rhetorical flourish, or it may mean something more sinister than that. But it didn't, whatever it was supposed to mean, didn't happen. The president was elected. I mean, if this was a deep state conspiracy, it was a very poorly executed one, because at the end of the day, he did, in fact, win the Electoral College victory. If not, of course, he didn't win the popular vote. And it's troubling that I think we are going to see this hurt the FBI even more than it has already been hurt. in the vortex between the Clinton email investigation and the special counsel's investigation into Russian meddling in the election.
And again, I'm speaking with Lisa Kern Griffin, a professor of law at Duke University who focuses on evidence theory, constitutional criminal procedure, and federal criminal justice policy. Previously, she clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor of the Supreme Court of the United States and also spent 5 years as a federal prosecutor in the Chicago United States Attorney's Office. So even if there is something to those seven words, no, no, he won't, we'll stop it, one FBI agent, it's not going to stop anybody from becoming president. I mean, isn't the implication here that Strzok is just the tip of an iceberg, that somehow there's a whole bunch of deep staters like him? Is that the case that President Trump and his allies are trying to make?
I think they'll make all kinds of different cases. I mean, they're not really prone to consistency, so there'll be different narratives that are spun out of this. Coming from all different directions, a rogue agent who was later somehow involved in the special counsel's investigation as well might be one version of it. The deep state, the we referenced here is a whole deep state cabal that was working against the president in the course of the campaign, that law enforcement agencies and the Department of Justice are somehow inherently corrupt and deeply corrupt, and that this is yet another example of that. There are many different ways in which I expect the conservative media will be spinning these few words of uncertain meaning in this private text exchange. I do, though, still think that, as many people have pointed out, yes, it is unfortunate, it is inappropriate, it is rightly criticized in this report, but it is not true that just because people are working in and for the federal government, they are not permitted to have views on elected officials or campaigning officials. And FBI agents have views. If they lean in any direction, they lean right as an organization. And I'm sure many of them, and certainly, for example, the New York FBI office, which had primary responsibility for the Hillary Clinton email investigation, leaned very strongly anti-Clinton. So you could spin the same narrative out on the other side. But they're entitled to those views, as all people are, and they're entitled even to express in private conversations those views. And nothing in the report, in fact, the report states that it's very clear there was no bias. There isn't anything implicating them in any conduct, actions, or bias that would themselves be nefarious. So it is a very unfortunate turn of phrase. We're going to be hearing it again and again. It probably doesn't mean anything at all.
But what's extraordinary is that this is old news. Back on the 2nd of December, the New York Times published the transcripts of these text messages between FBI lawyer Lisa Page and FBI agent Peter Strzok. And quite, I'd say, the balance of their criticism was pretty equally shared. She was very skeptical of Hillary Clinton and was more or less going to hold her nose and vote. And he wasn't particularly, he called himself a conservative Democrat, and he wasn't too thrilled with the choices either. So, again, there's not any context here, and I'm astounded that you could make hay out of such old news.
It is not a revelation. I think that the words themselves are the "we'll stop it," is a jarring turn of phrase. And I think for that reason, it's already been seized on by the communications office at the White House. I think we'll be hearing it from commentators in the days to come. There's a lot of other news right now that is not favorable for the president in terms of turns that are being taken in the special counsel's investigation, the New York Attorney General's suit against the Trump Foundation. There are a number of other things that they ran out, and the release of this report is fortuitous timing for them. At the same time, Director Comey has written an op-ed about his view that he understands that he's being criticized for some decisions that he's made, but he sees the Inspector General's report as a way of putting some of these things behind us and affirming the rule of law and the importance of scrutiny of actions taken in these settings. And there are other ways of reading the report. It certainly doesn't vindicate Director Comey, but it does suggest that he didn't make the wrong decision in not indicting Hillary Clinton, and that it might be time to put that particular narrative to rest as well.
Well, but the point is that Comey's been fired, Andrew McCabe's been fired, and other FBI agents that the Trump administration had problems with have been sort of sent off to some kind of internal Siberia. So it's not as if that the so-called villains in the piece, not that they really are, have already been punished. I mean, somebody recently suggested that if you watch Fox News, you would think that Hillary Clinton was president. I mean, that seems to be the broader kind of psychosis going on here. Who's really winning, I mean, in terms of the sort of injustice versus justice, or the imaginary injustice versus justice? I take your broader point that what this perhaps serves as a distraction from what Robert Mueller's up to. When do you think we'll get some clarity on this? Because this is not like what happened under the Whitewater thing that went on for like 8 years or something. This report may not necessarily, under the conditions that it was approved, be actually released to the public. And it's not like Watergate, where everybody saw it all unfold on their television screens. So to that extent, do you think that President Trump has an advantage, that he's able to muddy the waters and throw out these unsupported attacks to essentially condition the public to believe, not to believe this report if it comes out, and if and when it comes out, he's casting it as being politically biased?
I think that the president has a tremendous advantage in that he is tweeting, talking, and using certain conservative media as a mouthpiece for a narrative about the Mueller investigation that seems to have taken hold. I mean, it's undeniable that it is swaying public opinion about that investigation. And for their part, the investigators don't speak at all. They do their talking only in the courtroom, and they are in no way engaged in an effort to counteract whatever narrative the president chooses to put forward on any given day. Director Comey has been very vocal, of course, on his own behalf, and in telling some of the story of what happened before the special counsel was appointed. But as far as the conduct of the special counsel's investigation, that doesn't involve the time period of which Director Comey has written and spoken and he is editorializing about now. And there is no one telling that side of the story. And it's not clear at this juncture in what form and at what point in time that side of the story will come out, if ever.
Well, an awful lot has come out in the very, very good reporting from the New York Times and the Washington Post and other outlets, that if you put them all together, it's pretty hard not to see that something really happened here. This is not made up out of whole cloth.
I think that at this point, a significant portion of the public no longer cares. Mm-hmm. I think at least the firm base that the president seems to hold, that roughly 40% base, I think they are entirely persuaded that no matter what the investigation reveals, it was a witch hunt and the president has been wronged and the FBI is tainted. And that's where today's IG report is unhelpful, because it does, to some extent, again, cast an unflattering light on a handful of actors within the FBI who may have done nothing wrong, but were saying things that suggest bias. And that is the drumbeat that we are hearing about the Russia investigation. And the combination, the conflation of these two investigations is ultimately so damaging for the FBI, because it is in that confusion that the president has thrived.
Well, just in closing, it may well be that tomorrow, Paul Manafort, President Trump's first campaign, second, I guess he was, after Corey Lewandowski, campaign manager, might well have to go to jail. And we spoke before about how you made the point that the indictments really are the way that Mueller has of painting the picture of what he's working on and what perhaps he's leading towards. Do you expect any more of those? I mean, seeing Manafort go off to jail, does this sort of move the needle a little bit in the other direction?
It may move the needle a little bit in the direction of putting some pressure on Manafort. It's unclear whether he can be pressured into cooperating ultimately with the special counsel. Certainly being taken into custody is about as much pressure as one can apply, especially on a white-collar defendant like Paul Manafort. So I don't know how much we will learn about the course of the investigation beyond Paul Manafort's misconduct in trying to influence potential witnesses in the coming days in terms of whether or not he's taken into custody. But it may be a dangerous signal for the president if Paul Manafort is suddenly looking for a way to get out of custody. That development in the Michael Cohen case, there are a few other glimmers of information that will probably come out in the days and weeks to come. In terms of the main work of the special counsel investigation, they've been quiet for quite a while. They have been very quiet, and it's approaching summer, and you know, the midterm elections follow soon after that. And if there are going to be additional indictments, further information revealed, decisions made, it seems as though the end game, at least for maybe the midpoint of the investigation or some stopping point, has to be approaching in the months to come.
Well, Lisa Cohn Griffin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Lisa Cohn Griffin. She's a professor of law at Duke University who focuses on evidence theory, constitutional criminal procedure, and federal criminal justice policy. And previously, she clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor of the Supreme Court of the United States. And she also spent 5 years as a federal prosecutor in the Chicago United States Attorney's Office. Going to take a brief station break and back speaking with the Washington Post investor reporter about the converted Walmart where the U.S. is holding 1,500 immigrant children.
I'm more important in the USA than a spy for the FBI. I'm trained to meet the criminal elite and I seek out wherever evil resides.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking...
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Amber Brown, an investigative reporter at The Washington Post, where her latest article is Inside Casa Padre, the converted Walmart where the U.S. is holding nearly 1,500 immigrant children. Welcome to Background Briefing, Amber Brown.
I'm glad to be here.
And it looks as though, as a result of Senator Jeff Merkley showing up at this building, this converted Walmart, that they let the press in, right? I mean, he was prevented from entering, and it was kind of hilarious, the guards saying, what's your name? What's your job? He dutifully writes down, U.S. Senator.
They even called the police on him.
Right.
Yeah, and then they regret it, you know, put out a statement of regret later, but certainly that incident created some scrutiny of that particular facility and of the organization that runs that facility, which runs a whole bunch of other shelters for immigrant children around the border region. So, yeah, I mean, nobody said outright that that's why reporters were let in yesterday, but I think we can surmise that that was a big reason why they opened their doors.
So let's talk about the Southwest Key programs, or the Southwest Key, which is a nonprofit that's running a bunch of shelters and getting what's so far about $1 billion from the U.S. government. And the head of it is compensated rather well on top of that. This is an operation that's been going on for some time, but now it's burgeoning because of this zero tolerance policy enunciated by the Attorney General.
Yeah, I mean, Southwest Key has been around for 30 years. It was originally sort of a juvenile justice-focused organization, though, and pretty small. And it's just in the last decade or so that it's really started to get quite a bit bigger. And really, in the last few years, it's gotten, every year more money from the federal government to operate these shelters for immigrant youth. And so, as you said, there's been more than $1 billion just since 2014, and a big chunk of it this fiscal year, more than $300 million this year. And that expansion has helped drive up executive compensation. The head of it, in the most recent year available, had a total compensation package of almost $1.5 million. So yes, it's a thriving business. Although, you know, a year ago, the sort of spring surge of immigrant youth did not materialize, and Southwest Key laid off 1,000 people because they're in sort of this boom bust business that right now is really booming.
And the organization now houses 5,129 immigrant children, which is half of the approximate 11,200 currently in federal custody. But the head of Southwest Key refers to them, as particularly this Walmart center, as, "We're not a detention center. We're operating shelters that take care of kids." So what kind of distinction is that?
Right. Well, I mean, to some extent, it's language, right? Because these children are being held. They're not allowed to leave. And if they do leave, the employees call ICE to pick them up. So, you know, but on the other hand, we hear from advocates that of all the sort of stops along the way for these young people, these shelters are safe and well run for the most part. And so they are being, in a sense, detained, but it is a more comfortable detention than, say, the short-term holding centers that are sometimes called ICE boxes at the border, run by Border Patrol agents. So, you know, they live four to a room, or now five to a room, because there are so many kids in this one facility. And they have 2 hours a day outside. They can make 2 phone calls a week. You know, there's a lot of rules. That they are in an institution. It's not like being at home.
And my understanding is that as you enter this big box Walmart or converted Walmart, the first thing you see is a portrait of Donald Trump.
It is one of the first things that you see, and just to be clear, it's one of there are a number of murals of U.S. presidents in this place, so it's not like his is the only one, but it is interesting that it is one of the first that you would see, with a quote from originally thought it was a tweet of his from 2014, but it turns out the first time it appeared was in The Art of the Deal, his 1987 book. And it says, you know, if you something about losing the battle helps you find another way to win the war.
And the Trump administration, of course, is talking about erecting tent cities. I don't know whether that's something he got from Sheriff Joe Arpaio, but this is clearly preferable to a tent city. But the fact that they're all boys between the ages of 10 and 17?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
So presumably there's a similar facility somewhere for girls.
There is an all-girls facility, although this one is by far the largest. It's just sort of on an order of magnitude larger than others in Texas.
Well, there's a really heartbreaking picture on the front page of Thursday's New York Times of a 2-year-old child sobbing while her mother is up against a vehicle with her hands on the roof being frisked by an ICE officer. And the impression is that the child is going to be separated from the mother. What's the percentage of the kids in this Walmart that have been separated from their parents? And if so, what kind of special treatment do they get? Because one would assume that they're traumatized.
Right. Well, as you said, this facility serves children ages 10 to 17. And most of them are children that, like in recent years, are from... They came to the border alone. They're older minors, mostly teenagers, who came to the border unaccompanied. And then only about 5% of them, according to the head of Southwest Key, are the young people who are separated from their parents. Other Southwest Key shelters have higher proportions, but this one is mostly still older teenagers who came by themselves. But, you know, I mean, advocates have a lot of concern about whether facilities like Casa Padre are that are used to serving the older youth, the ones who came on their own, whether they are equipped to serve the really particular needs of kids who are not just fleeing some kind of trauma in their home country, but are actually in the midst of experiencing the trauma of being taken from their parents unexpectedly. So there's a lot of concern that those kids aren't in a situation to get the care that they need.
Well, that would be pretty heartbreaking, wouldn't it? I mean, the assumption would be if you could find a facility and identify one where the younger kids are kept, particularly, for example, the two-year-old I was referring to who was on the front page of the New York Times today. And I believe that even younger kids, I think there was a woman was breastfeeding and the child was taken away from her at the border. So wherever these kids are.
Yeah, reporters have not been allowed in those facilities where those children are being held. The Federal Health and Human Services, who sort of oversees the operation of these shelters, and they have very strict rules about any disclosure to the public of anything going on. And they're not, you're not even supposed to publish addresses of where these shelters are. And so, and that's why Senator Merkley was turned away when he tried to visit Casa Padre. And so we have not been allowed to visit where the younger children are. And I completely agree with you that would be a worthy thing to report on. And I hope that we get to visit.
But as you point out, it's a sort of, it's double-edged, isn't it? On the one hand, the privacy of these children is being protected. But on the other hand, the public is not seeing what I think is probably particularly for these young children, a pretty traumatic situation. And I can't imagine if you've got hundreds of young kids, maybe, under the age of 2 or 3 in some facility, it just sounds like it would be heartbreaking just on the surface.
Yeah, I think that it is the younger children who have been separated from their parents, who have really sort of captured the sympathetic heart of many Americans who see that and sort of can imagine, can try to imagine what that would be like if it happened to them. And of course, the notion of having your children taken away is horrifying to anybody. So I think there's an intense interest in this country in understanding what's happening with those children, what kind of care they're receiving, will they and how will they be reunited with their parents.
Well, this has led some people to sort of talk about World War II, the kinder transports from the Jewish parents who had to give up their children in Germany and Austria. And I know that sounds and probably is a little hyperbolic, but nevertheless, that's the residue of images we have. There hasn't been a lot of this kind of separation of children from their parents in our history. You more or less have to go back to the late 1930s, don't you? I mean, I can't think of any other example, except maybe in horrible sort of famines and stuff like that in the Third World.
Well, and the Trump administration's response to questions about the morality of this practice has been, their parents have broken the law. If you break the law, this is, you go to jail in this country, and that's what happens when you are a U.S. citizen, and that is what's going to happen if you come here illegally. But there are, advocates are very concerned that people who come and present and are seeking asylum who are not doing anything illegal are also being kind of swept up in this practice. And of course, advocates are also concerned just that even if people are coming illegally, that there is a human right to be with your family.
Well, this, of course, is obviously affecting the debate in the House, which has been stalled because the lame duck speaker, Paul Ryan, is not able to wrangle the factions on the Republican side. They want to get some kind of bill out before the elections. And Nancy Pelosi is suggesting that it simply can't be done because the gap between moderate to Republicans, if indeed there are that many left, and the hardliners like the Freedom Caucus is so profound that it's not going to happen. So what we're talking about is obviously on their minds, isn't it? I mean, they're thinking in terms of the optics affecting them getting reelected.
Well, I think that the situation with the children at the border is certainly is you know, taking an issue that was already so polarizing and that people have such intense feelings about, and just sort of ratcheting that up, right? And so it does seem like it's creating pressure for lawmakers to confront and weigh in on what's going on. I mean, we saw that with Paul Ryan, who just came out and said he didn't think it was right. We saw just a few minutes ago, I think Sarah Sanders at the White House briefing was asked about whether it was biblical to remove children from their parents, and she said, well, it's biblical to follow the law. But I think certainly this is an issue that people in public life are going to be confronted with more and more as long as it continues.
So specifically in terms of Ryan trying to wrangle a vote, I believe, is it Tuesday that the caucus is going to meet? As far as I know, there's still no vote scheduled.
You know, I'm not aware of whether there's a vote scheduled. But I think it does seem, I think, you know, you said before, it seems difficult to imagine that there could be an agreement.
So just in closing then, what's your sense of as a reporter, thanks to, I guess, Senator Merkley, going down there and trying to bang on the door, that sort of guilted the authorities, if you will, into allowing reporters in, and now we're getting a glimpse. Even though I haven't seen any pictures, there was only print, right? Was there any video of what this place looks like?
Actually, yeah, the Health and Human Services sent up, they did not allow reporters to take pictures or video, but they took pictures or video, you know, being very careful not to show young people's faces and so on. And so those are available on our website, the video and some of the pictures, and also on the Health and Human Services website. So you can get a sense for what it looks like and feels like a little bit inside the Casa Padre.
And the website is what, Washington Post?
Yes, WashingtonPost.com.
Well, just in closing, though, just referencing your, I don't know whether I could refer to the New York Times as your rival newspaper, but the front page picture again of the 2-year-old, I think she was, bawling her eyes out while her mother's being frisked and up against a vehicle with an ICE guy behind her frisking her. It really does speak volumes, and it's really quite shocking. So do you think that we're going to see more of that throughout this year? Because I'm not sure that there's a, is there an end game here, do you think? Have the Trump people worked it out? Obviously, they're trying to send a signal to Central America, don't come up here, this is what happens to you. And in many ways, that's how they've justified the zero tolerance policy, that it's a deterrent. But in the meantime, these kids are caught in this situation, are they not? And they are the collateral damage.
Well, and the most recent numbers that came out showed that if it is meant as a deterrent, it's not working, because the flows of people in through the southern border is not slowing; it's speeding up. So, I mean, you asked, "What will we see more of this?" It seems we will, at least for a while. And you know, I think I think we'll also see more of it, not only because there are more people coming, but because the media is really, I think, tuned into and engaged now on this issue in a way it wasn't months ago. You know, advocates say Sessions just announced this policy on May 7th, but advocates have been sort of trying to raise awareness about it for months before that, because they had been seeing it happen in all along the border. So anyway, I think because the media is more tuned in now, people will be seeing those images that you're referring to.
Well, Emma Brown, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Amber Brown, who's an investigative reporter at The Washington Post, where her latest article is Inside Casa Padre, the converted Walmart where the U.S. is holding nearly 1,500 immigrant children. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with an update on the worsening situation in Yemen, which is already a humanitarian catastrophe.
There's a place where I've been told every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Dr. Sheila Carapico, is a professor of political science and international studies at the University of Richmond, where she researches the political economy of development, a special emphasis on Arab countries. She was previously the chair of the political science department at the American University of Cairo, and is the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia. And she also is a contributing editor to the Middle East Report, and her latest book is Arabia Incognita, Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Sheila Carapico.
Thank you very much.
And there's an offensive underway in Yemen it's a Saudi-led coalition, and it looks like they're trying to take this rebel-held city of Hudaydah. Is that how you pronounce it?
Hudaydah.
And it's a key port for aid supplies to come into the country, which are, of course, inadequate because there's widespread starvation and a blockade underway. So just on the surface, if they capture this port, wouldn't that make the situation worse, the humanitarian situation worse?
Well, that certainly seems to be the opinion of the spokespersons for the major humanitarian organizations, including the UN and some of the non-governmental organizations. So I think we have to take their word for it.
So this is a deliberate strategy then?
It would really appear to be a deliberate strategy, and has appeared so for a long time. I mean, the inspections regime, which the UN has in place, is quite rigorous, and yet ships are kept waiting. Many ships actually have to go to Saudi Arabia first to be approved. They have, of course, disabled the main cranes, that are used for offloading from ships. And so there has been, you know, again, a very stringent blockade, justified as an embargo against the receipt of weapons. And they keep insisting that weapons are coming in through Hodeidah port, but, you know, there's never any photographic evidence. A special UN report found no evidence. The testimony, again, of the international humanitarian organizations is that there is no evidence that weapons are coming in. But in the name of preventing weapons, they have very severely restricted the flow of, you know, basic foods, fuels, and medicines, among the most important categories of things that normally would be coming through Hodeidah.
So this being discussed in the UN today as we speak, is there any expectation that there'll be any action on the part of the UN?
No.
And why is that?
Because the United States and also Britain and France have been very wishy-washy about this. I mean, they say things like, please be careful what you bomb. For example, I'm sure you noticed a couple of days ago they bombed a Médecins Sans Frontières hospital quite north of Hodeidah, but in the same general region. So they don't, the great powers, the Security Council, do not have a record of actually expending any energy to try to defuse this predominantly the bombing campaign. Secondly, you know, Saudi Arabia in particular has a lot of leverage and has threatened at various times to withdraw its funds to the United Nations. I'm not sure that in and of itself constrains the Security Council, but it clearly introduces another layer of reluctance to be firm on this matter. And then, of course, you know, one of the reasons why the United States, Britain, and France are reluctant to put too much pressure on the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, who are certainly partners in this, is that they're, you know, utilizing American, Canadian, and Western European weapons, which is quite lucrative for the arms manufacturers in those countries. And then in addition, of course, I mean, Nikki Haley and the Trump administration are openly sympathetic to the Saudi-led campaign.
So when the Congressman Ted Lieu, a Democrat here in Los Angeles, when he says the U.S. must now withdraw all its military support of the Saudi and UAE military coalition. The U.S. already has blood on its hands in the Yemen crisis. We should not make them even bloodier. Is Ted Lieu, Congressman Ted Lieu, a sort of voice in the wilderness, if you will?
Well, he and Chris Murphy of Connecticut, at one point Bernie Sanders, and then you'll have to forgive me for not remembering the name of the other Republican. So there, but there are a handful of senators who recognize how two things, I think. One is that this really does not serve any part of the U.S. national interest to be, for example, refueling fighter jets that are bombing hospitals.
Saudi fighter jets, you mean?
Yeah, Saudi fighter jets, American-made Saudi fighter jets that are bombing hospitals. And the second thing, you know, is, of course, that, I mean, we are, I think, there's a lot of consensus that we're complicit in war crimes.
So is the U.S. compromised in the sense that the Trump administration and the White House inner circle, particularly Trump himself and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, have really bonded, if you will, with the new Saudi crown prince, soon to be king, and MBZ, who is MBS's mentor and the Emirati leader. And, you know, there's obviously financial dealings underway with the Trump organization, particularly Jared Kushner, whose real estate empire is in trouble because of a bad investment at 666 Fifth Avenue. There have been reports of a shakedown of the Qataris for $500 million. They apparently turned it down, but more recently, the Qataris now have invested in the Kushner company. So it seems just pretty obvious to me that you have a situation where our leaders are not honest brokers, to say the least, and they may well be compromised, and they're certainly not exercising any moral suasion here in the face of this horrible humanitarian catastrophe that the Saudis are causing in Yemen. So do you think that that's a problem, that we have a White House in doing business with the very people who are bombing hospitals in Yemen?
Well, I mean, yes, of course. I think you and I and probably most people who listen to your program would find that really shocking. And the reports, the recent reports of the kind of financial dealings between Kushner and Trump and these, you know, Gulf monarchies, which are, by the way, misogynist and repressive and so forth, is particularly shocking. So we're getting new and more shocking revelations. But this is not new or unique to the Trump administration. It was equally true on the corruption level, not equally true. But, you know, Obama visited Kingdom of Saudi Arabia quite a number of times. The Clinton campaign received contributions and the Clinton Foundation contributions from these same monarchies. So, I mean, we've sunk to a new low in terms of the level of corruption, but the relationship between the United States and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in particular, but, you know, also the United Arab Emirates, and then it's a little bit complicated now with Qatar and Bahrain because of discord among these monarchies. But, you know, we're, as a nation, we're very deeply implicated. It's common knowledge for those of us who watch Yemen closely that, you know, most of the bombs that are dropped have made in the USA on them. So there are little kids going around all the time picking up fragments that say made in the U.S. And there's a widespread perception that because these are American bombs and they're dropping on Yemeni houses and schools and bridges that, you know, this is an American war, which has been, of course, Yemen didn't used to be an anti-American place, but in many communities now it is very, very much so. So there are layers of the complications you're alluding to.
So with this Saudi-led coalition now moving on the port of Hodeidah, which they obviously want to close off, and that would starve the Yemenis even further since they're under a blockade. But will it end the war? It seems like the Houthis are incredibly resilient. They still control the capital, Sana'a, and their territory in northern Yemen, which is their ancestral land. So from a military point of view, What do you think is going on? I mean, the general consensus of analysts has been from the beginning that the Saudi boy king has bitten off more than he can chew, and he really sort of impulsively got into this war without thinking it through, and there's no end game, and he's got a quagmire in his hand. So now it appears that he's trying to break out of that quagmire. So what's your sense of whether there's an end in sight to this agony?
Well, I mean, there are people who argue that, you know, the Houthis can be defeated militarily. But I think the more sober kind of military strategy analysts that I follow, you know, point to a number of factors. One is that it's exceedingly difficult for any government to wipe out basically a militia movement, a guerrilla movement. You know, look at Afghanistan twice, Iraq, Vietnam, I mean, you know, anti-colonial struggles. I mean, that kind of decisive victory is extremely difficult to achieve militarily. And that's in part because for a non-state actor, which includes these Houthis, and that term actually is complicated, but merely surviving is a victory. So, and the other thing is about this particular group, the Houthis, is they don't, none of us can discern that they have a particular strategy either, other than to just keep fighting. And so the idea that they're thinking all that strategically is questionable, shall we say. But, you know, defeating them militarily seems unlikely. And incidentally, I mean, El Hodeida, the port city, the people there don't sympathize with the Houthis at all. They're not, they have nothing in common. And there aren't huge numbers of Houthis there. So we're also, or the bombing campaign now is inflicting, you know, great trauma on probably 600,000 or 500,000 people in the city, among whom are maybe, I don't know, I can't find a really reliable number, but maybe 20,000 fighters. And so it's also difficult to imagine just the logistics of how exactly you're going to target those people without targeting, you know, the larger population. So I haven't seen a persuasive argument that this campaign is going to result in what the Saudis and the Emiratis keep insisting on, which is just an unconditional surrender.
Well, at this point, the Saudis have flown more than 100,000 combat missions,
sorties,
and they have put this coalition together, which includes, by the way, 7,000 Sudanese mercenaries.
Right.
But the Houthis, as far as we know, have about 100,000 fighters, and it would seem to me that the collateral damage is what the real issue is here. You've got 28 million people in this country, a third of whom, according to the UN, are suffering from food insecurity, with 50,000 children having died so far from hunger. And now that they'll close off this port, assuming they take the port of Hodeida, that will tighten the screws even further. So you'll have even more starvation, won't you?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there's a consensus on that, that it's almost inevitable. I mean, again, you and I both have seen, you know, quite a few interviews in the past couple of days with, you know, aid workers and humanitarian workers and UN people and, you know, food specialists all basically reaching the same conclusion that a shutdown of the port, even just for a few days, would exacerbate starvation and, of course, the lack of medicine, which is also a big problem because of the cholera outbreak, which, again, is there's pretty strong evidence that that is a direct result of deliberate targeting of water supplies and wastewater treatment plants. So it's not a natural cholera outbreak. It's a cholera outbreak that was at least exacerbated and quite possibly caused by deliberate targeting of basically water and sanitation supplies.
Well, we've heard nothing from President Trump expressing any concern or interest in the plight of the Yemeni people and the humanitarian catastrophe that the UN has been warning about for some time. As far as I know, the only reference he's made is that the bombing of Yemen has been good for American arms manufacturers. Is that Am I correct?
He had said that. I don't think he would use the word, but it's what we would call military Keynesianism.
What did he say specifically? Because I don't remember the exact quote.
You know, actually, I'm not sure I can quote verbatim either. But it was something very close to the Saudis are buying a lot of beautiful American weapons, and that provides good American jobs. Again, that's not verbatim, but it was something like that. And it was on the occasion of the Crown Prince's visit to the United States. And of course, you know, he was being feted all over the place. But in particular, you know, Trump was praising him very strongly, and the main thing that the President Trump was so happy about was the sale of weapons. And, you know, I don't know that he even mentioned that they're being used actively in a war, contrary to various American guidelines on how they would be used. But he did explicitly say that it's good for American jobs.
Well, just in closing, since you're a specialist on Yemen, Dr. Sheila Karapiko, and you're watching this country die effectively with indifference from our White House and enormous arrogance on the part of this boy king in Saudi Arabia, is there any way out?
You know, I really don't see any way out. I mean, just I would add one point, actually, which is, that now is the feast at the end of Ramadan. So it's a high holy holiday during which, you know, the poorest people, I mean, the people around Hodeidah are the poorest people in Yemen, and they're being bombed on their holy day, holy weekend. The UN has not taken the lead. The United States actively really opposes and has tried to thwart a few peace initiatives that came from places like the Netherlands. And the Yemenis themselves, I mean, you know, they're caught in a horrible war. And I have, you know, it's not that I think one sympathizes with the Houthis particularly, much less the so-called legitimate government that the Saudis claim to be supporting, who's been living in Saudi Arabia for 3 years. I mean, those guys, one cannot look to the Yemeni leadership for a way out of this either. So, you know, if the UN can't do it and the Gulf monarchies are actively perpetuating the war and the Yemenis are not able to do it, then it's pretty hard to see how, you know, there are peace efforts. This is when women are doing amazing things. But, you know, they can't stop fighter jets.
Well, Dr. Sheila Karapiko, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're more than welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sheila Karapiko, Professor of Political Science and International Studies at the University of Richmond. Previously, she was the chair of the Political Science Department at the American University of Cairo and is the author of Civil Society in Yemen, The Political Economy of Activism in Modern Arabia. And she is also a contributing editor to Middle East Report. And her latest book is Arabia Incognita, Dispatches from Yemen and the Gulf. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Larivalat. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.